I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last year, on January 25th, thousands of Egyptians took to the streets in Cairo to protest the government of Hosni Mubarak, corruption, unemployment, and the injustices in their country. A year later, Mubarak, who had been in power for three decades, is on trial, and Egyptians are grappling with their newfound freedoms. Our guest, Stephen A. Cook, writes in his new book, The Struggle for Egypt, that there are some interesting parallels between Egypt today and Egypt in 1952, when Gamal Abdel Nasser staged a coup and became president. Cook's book is subtitled From Nasser to Tahrir Square. He's a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Stephen Cook, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
You were in Egypt right before Christmas. How would you describe that country today?
Well, Egyptians are clearly struggling with a new political order. They are engaged in a furious debate about what kind of society they want, what kind of government they want. They are struggling against also the vestiges of the Mubarak regime, many of whom see that in military rule that has been imposed on Egypt since Mubarak's fall. They suspect the officers are trying to salvage what they can of the Mubarak era and thwart the revolutionary promise of Tahrir Square. So it is a contested environment. It is an unstable environment. When I was there, I witnessed what became known as the Battle of Kasr al-Aini Street, in which people were killed and injured in a horrible kind of episode in which military police were raining Molotov cocktails down on citizens from buildings above. Egypt is in the throes, as they say.
It has been holding these parliamentary elections, and we were talking before the show began, and you said, you know, by and large, the elections look pretty clean.
They have been. All three rounds with turnout over 50%, which is probably 48 to 50% better than it was during the Mubarak era. International observers, although they can't be called observers in Egypt, they actually are technically called witnesses, have not reported any major problems with fraud or ballot stuffing. Egyptians, when I was there for the second round of elections, these elections have happened over the course of 3 months in three phases. I was there for the second round of elections. Egyptians queued up and waited patiently in order to cast their votes. The elections themselves have not been the problem. The problem has been the continuation of military rule.
And I do want to pick up on that. What would you say has – where is the Arab Spring now, just about a year later, looking at Egypt?
Well, I'm not sure I would call it an Arab Spring. Spring evokes nice things, flowers, warmth. And it is at this point very hard to tell what direction Egypt or any of the other countries in the region are going to take. This transition from the authoritarianism of Mubarak and Sadat and Nasser before them is going to take a very long time. And transitions from authoritarianism to democracy do not happen from one point to another very smoothly. There'll be reversals. There'll be changes of course. It is entirely possible that Egypt does not come out of this with a democratic system. It may come up with some kind of illiberal democratic system, a renewed type of authoritarianism. So it's a little hasty to call it a spring, but the uprising,
a thaw, maybe?
A thaw perhaps. Yes, that's a good one. There is tremendous promise. Egyptians clearly want to live in a more democratic society, one with social justice, where Egypt has an important place in the world as well.
Well, as we know, the Islamists have done pretty well in these parliamentary elections. And Stephen, you wrote in looks like foreignpolicy.com, if the revolutionaries and their supporters are now stunned that the Islamists are set to dominate post-uprising Egypt, they must take a hard look at what they have done or not done over the last 11 months. What haven't they done?
Well, the instigators of the revolution achieved tremendous amount bringing down Hosni Mubarak. Virtually no one predicted this. They were stunned on February 11th when Mubarak took his flight to Sharm el-Sheikh.
Since they themselves were stunned
that they were able to do it. They thought the January 25th uprising, a long-planned demonstration to coincide with police day in Egypt, would be a 1 or 2 day affair, and they would look forward to the time when Mubarak passed from the scene naturally. Since that time, however, they have been manifestly unable to organize, to gain traction with the broader public. I think a turning point was as early as the March 19 referendum last year. The referendum was on a series of constitutional revisions that would guide the transitional period. The revolutionary groups were opposed to those constitutional revisions because they felt that they favored the military and the Muslim Brotherhood. They campaigned against them. Well, more than 75% of the Egyptian public voted for those constitutional revisions. And as a result, the revolutionaries turned back to becoming a permanent revolution. And over the course of the summer and spring, engaged in 17 Friday of preserving the revolution, Friday of persistence, and so on and so forth. This had diminishing returns in terms of the kinds of political work that needed to be done in order to prepare themselves for an election and put Egypt on a path that they saw would be appropriate. They lost the momentum and they handed it to the Brotherhood, which had essentially an 80-year head start on them and was well organized to begin with. But still, a lot of blame needs to be laid at the feet of the revolutionaries as well as the new political parties that emerged after the uprising.
What explains, though, the popularity of the Brotherhood? As you say, they've been around for 80 years, started back in the beginning, the 1920s. How have they been able to garner the kind of support that they have in Egypt?
I think in a number of important ways. First, they have had this longevity. They have been around. And that has given them certainly an advantage. They're also well-resourced, well-organized organization. Two other things I think are extraordinarily important here. One, in Egypt, as the state has retreated from the education and cultural sphere, and even in providing basic government services, the Brotherhood has stepped in. And that has become an important mechanism of political mobilization, not just for a hardcore constituency, but for average Egyptians in need of medical care, in need of legal representation, in need of medicines. You name it, the Brotherhood was there. This turned people out into the polls. The other important thing is that the Brotherhood articulates a positive vision of Egyptian society and what Egyptian society should look like. They point to the huge gap between what the previous government under Mubarak said about Egyptian society and what the reality was. And in between, the Brotherhood has stepped in and said, this is what Egyptian society should look like, and this is how we're going to achieve it. And importantly, they've couched that in a religious vernacular that resonates with a lot of Egyptians.
But do they have what would be called extremist views about their country, about religion, the role of religion in their country?
Well, there are question marks about the Muslim Brotherhood. First of all, it's the granddaddy of all Islamist movements, and it's never repudiated its ultimate goal of Islamizing society from below and establishing an Islamic state under Sharia or Islamic law. That raises questions about the role of the Coptic population, which is estimated to be about 10%, the role of other minorities, women, people who don't agree with their particular interpretation of Islam. But we should be clear also that the Brotherhood is not an extremist organization. It is relatively liberal in comparison to others, and over the course of the last few decades has appropriated the language of reform and change that, without the kind of religious vernacular that's added to it, wouldn't look terribly different from other opposition groups in Egypt.
But it's interesting reading your book and looking at some of this history is that whether we're talking about Nasser or Mubarak, they have put their thumb on the Muslim Brotherhood, obviously fearing this group within Egypt.
That's absolutely right. And I think the fear is not necessarily that Mubarak and Nasser stood for secularism, although they're both secular in their worldview, but that the Brotherhood is a legitimate competitor for power. And we're seeing that in elections, that the fact that in Egypt's first free and fair election since the end of this regime that was founded in 1952, or we think the end of the regime that was founded in 1952, that the Brotherhood has done extraordinarily well. So they're the natural competitors of the previous presidents, and in fact, the military that now holds executive authority in the country.
I began by talking about the fact that you see some interesting parallels between 1952 and today in Egypt. Just picking up on that, what are those parallels?
Well, it's only for someone like myself who's spent 2.5 years marinating myself in Egyptian history that, and of course I'm too young to actually remember, but on a daily basis say, well, that sounds like the spring of 1954. And in essence, this period that we're going through now is reminiscent in many ways in the struggle for the free officers when they came to power in 1952 to consolidate their power.
Let me stop you there. The free officers, and this goes back to Nasser.
This is the free officers who came to power were led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, who established the Egypt that we think about today. That these guys, like today's military, don't really have a plan, don't really understand politics, and are struggling to deal with politics, the economy, a whole host of problems. What the free officers did after the course of 18 months, they discovered authoritarian solutions to these internal problems. And you got the monster of a regime that was brought down in January and February of 2011. The question now is, what's the next step? These officers are confronting problems that they never thought that they would confront. They never thought they would confront them when they brought Mubarak down themselves. Will they seek authoritarian solutions? That's what the revolutionaries believe that they will. And I tend to agree with them that they will seek authoritarian solutions. They want to ensure a more democratic future for Egypt. But the military is engaged in a whole series of machinations to thwart that. It's very reminiscent to the period in the early 1950s.
So we can draw a line from the free officers of the 1950s to the Egyptian military today?
Absolutely. This is the regime that the revolutionaries brought down last February was the regime that was founded by Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar Sadat and other free officers. The personnel may have changed, but the kind of infrastructure of the regime, the way in which it ruled, remained essentially the same, with critical changes, of course, but the same.
We're almost up on a break here, but what's interesting, this goes back a year, at least initially, the protesters seem to think that the military, if not neutral, might even have been on their side. Feels very different a year later.
It does feel very different. I think the hardcore revolutionaries from the start were concerned about the military. I mean, the senior officer corps was all picked by Mubarak. They all benefited from the regime that he oversaw. I think they were somewhat distrustful. But again, the military came out very forcefully and said that they were with the legitimate demands of the people. And quite honestly, had the military not broken from Mubarak, it's possible that he and his advisors around him may have been able to survive. The problem is that the military believed that Mubarak was the problem and that they could carry on without him, that he was putting the country and the regime in jeopardy, and that they could salvage what they could from the previous regime. They are now confronting tremendous, as they say, pushback from broad sectors of Egyptian society.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Stephen A. Cook today about Egypt. He's got a new book called The Struggle for Egypt, subtitled From Nasser to Tahrir Square. We're going to take a very short break, pick up where we left off and open up the lines. Any questions or comments you might have about Egypt and also U.S.-Egypt relations, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo, wishing you a happy and healthy new year. We're celebrating in all my restaurants, 4710 and 2012, the Year of the Dragon with a special Year of the Dragon menu. Margaret Kuo's restaurants support WHYY.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
Believe it or not, when Al Gore invented the internet, it was with YStream in mind.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to radio programs without pledge breaks.
And it'll be available to you during WHYY's upcoming member drive.
For all the details, including special discounts for current members, visit whyy.org/YStream.
We hope you'll look forward to not hearing us during the member drive.
And thanks for your support.
This week on This American Life, Mike Daisy was on an Apple computer fan site and read about a guy who bought an iPhone, and it wasn't blank.
It had information on it from inside the factory, and in fact, in the camera roll, there were pictures on it from inside the factory.
Mike stared at those pictures, then flew to China to stand outside the factory gates and meet these workers.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is affiliated with the Cleveland Clinic's Heart Surgical Program. Their surgeons are performing breakthrough procedures, including minimally invasive heart valve surgeries. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Much has changed in Egypt as the country prepares to mark the first anniversary of the uprising at Tahrir Square in Cairo. The former president, Hosni Mubarak, is on trial. The Muslim Brotherhood won big in the parliamentary elections. We're talking about all of this with Stephen A. Cook. He has visited Egypt a number of times, most recently right before Christmas, author of a new book called The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. Again, a senior fellow for the Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see if we can shoehorn about 60 years of history and into a couple of minutes here, Stephen. But going back to when Nasser took control and the, I guess, the significance of his coup back in 1952, the coup that he helped to orchestrate.
Well, the coup brought an end to an Albanian Ottoman dynasty that had ruled Egypt since 1805, and the last king of Egypt was King Farouk, and the free officers sent him off to Italy. And their initial project was to reform the Egyptian political system. There was a parliament, didn't function all that well, but after facing a whole host of opposition, they pursued authoritarian solutions to their problems. And that's essentially the regime that they bequeathed to Nasser's successor, Anwar Sadat, and then the regime that he bequeathed to Hosni Mubarak. Nasser is different from Sadat, and Sadat's different from Mubarak, in that Nasser pursued ultimately something that we call Nasserism, mm-hmm. which is a vague form of socialism, a redistribution of wealth. There was the nationalization of industries during the Nasser period. Nasser pursued a foreign policy that was called positive neutralism, which was essentially he was a prominent figure in the non-aligned movement, but it was essentially playing the big powers off of each other to get what they wanted in an effort to achieve a certain status for Egypt in the world.
And I guess he had the advantage of this was the Cold War, when you could play powers off each other.
Exactly. You know, he sought financing for the High Aswan Dam from the United States. The United States said no. He went to the Soviets, and the Soviets built the dam. So this was something that during a time in the mid-1950s and 1960s resonated deeply with Egyptians, primarily because Nasserism seemed to be working. There was expanded economic opportunity for the lower and middle classes. There was expanded educational opportunity. There was seemingly social justice, which was extraordinarily important to Egyptians through the early part of the 20th century. It's important today. Egypt seemed to be important in the global stage after years of foreign domination. Nasser's regime, though, started to teeter with the June 1967 defeat at the hands of Israel. It revealed the hollowness of the things that Nasser had been doing over the previous 19 years. He died in 1970 in a heart attack. Anwar Sadat became the next president, and he sought to correct the problems that he perceived. It was called the corrective revolution. And he started talking about what's called a state of institutions, which was his way of talking about a more democratic Egypt. He pursued infitah, economic opening, and he put Egypt firmly in the Western camp. These were major changes in Egypt through the 1970s.
And he, of course, was assassinated. And do you think that's tied to the Egypt-Israeli peace treaty, that the fact that these two countries, and he received the Nobel Peace Prize or shared it for that. Was that his undoing, do you think, in Egypt?
Well, it certainly was in part. By the time of Sadat's assassination, Egypt was more contested than ever. The things that he did, calling for a state of institutions, which wasn't very serious, the economic opening and the alignment with the West, which ultimately led to the peace treaty with Israel, didn't make sense to a lot of Egyptians. And, of course, Islamist extremists saw him as having sold out. Many Egyptians to this day see the peace treaty with Israel as a separate peace and therefore a shameful peace. And it has been an issue that has plagued the Israel-Egypt relationship and the U.S.-Egypt relationship. But to suggest that Sadat was assassinated only because he made that famous trip to Jerusalem and only because he signed the Egypt-Israel peace treaty is to forget a whole previous decade of history that went before.
And for Hosni Mubarak, who obviously took over after Sadat's assassination, did thinking about some of these reforms and improvements, did life get better, get worse under Mubarak?
Well, it's funny. One of my interlocutors in Egypt knows the former First Lady, Suzanne Mubarak, and they've had a number of conversations since Mubarak's fall. And she has asked him, didn't we do anything over the course of 30 years that was positive? And in fact, if you look at the socioeconomic indicators that the World Bank produces, there were important changes, enormous changes. In the book, I kind of describe the difference between October 1981 and February 2011 in Egypt. Egyptians certainly benefited from that 30-year period. The problem is, and what clearly Mrs. Mubarak and Mr. Mubarak didn't understand, is that you can't beat people into submission in the process of developing the country. Now,
and you mean that, right?
Literally.
Coercion,
beat people,
beating.
Right, exactly. I mean, anybody who raised a question about politics, about foreign policy, were met with the rattan canes and metal pipes of the Interior Ministry Central Security Forces. I think the problem is also is that there was development in Egypt, but it was concentrated among a relatively small group of people. And 40% of the population was still living on less than $2 a day.
Mm. Which raises a whole host of questions, including the U.S. relationship with Egypt. It has been a recipient of U.S. foreign aid. I think number two, Israel being number one, Egypt being number two. How would you describe the relationship between Egypt and the United States today?
Well, I think that we are in the process of the long goodbye between Egypt and the United States. That's not to suggest that I expect a rupture in U.S.-Egypt relationship, but the strategic alignment that Washington has enjoyed, the benefits of strategic alignment, I think are rapidly coming to an end. Egypt was a key player in helping to create a regional political order that made it relatively easier and less expensive for the United States to pursue its interests in the Middle East. In Egypt, where public opinion matters more, a more democratic Egypt, even a semi-authoritarian Egypt where public opinion is going to matter more as a result of the uprising last year, is not going to tolerate this close alignment between the United States and Egypt. The revolutionary narrative is that Mubarak pursued Washington and Israel's interests, not Egypt's interests, that actually Mubarak's foreign policy warped Egyptian foreign policy, warped its interests, all for the benefit of Egypt, for the United States and Israel.
So public opinion in Egypt about the United States is, I mean, when you see some of these public opinion polls, it's really low. I mean, in the single digits in many ways.
It is indeed. Now, that's not to suggest that Washington didn't do good things in Egypt. We helped develop Egyptian infrastructure. We helped electrify the countryside. We are the backstop for Egypt's virtually non-existent public health system. But that's not what Egyptians focus on. They focus on the United States propping up an illegitimate dictator for its own interests and rendering Egypt a second-rate power in the region as a result of that close alignment with the United States and, by association, Israel.
Which takes us back to the very careful words that President Obama spoke after the Tahrir Square protests. Also, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking very carefully, both, you know, encouraging the protests, but also not wanting to lose control of the region.
Absolutely. I mean, this was an extraordinarily difficult moment for anybody. There's no playbook. There's no precedent. You know, 1989 Eastern Europe has nothing on 2011 in the Arab world, and in particular Egypt. I will say, though, having been in Tahrir Square for the beginning of the uprising and seeing the president's statements and the Secretary of State statement and their spokesman's statements, they were behind the curve. They were hopelessly behind the curve. You got that sense on January 25th and 26th that the lesson of Tunisia was learned in Egypt, that bringing down Ben Ali in Tunisia on January 14th gave Egyptians hope. They didn't expect that they would bring down Mubarak, but it gave them hope, and they were going for broke. What I heard in Tahrir Square was an end to the regime, democracy, an end to the rule of the Mubarak family.
Well, as Rumsfeld famously said, democracy can be messy, right?
Indeed.
I don't necessarily like to quote him. Stephen A. Cook is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Egypt, Egypt's relationship with the United States and its neighbors. He's the author of a new book called The Struggle for Egypt, and it's subtitled From Nasser to Tahrir Square, looking at about 60 years of history in Egypt. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 77WHYY, a very important part of the world. Let me get to, it looks like Michael from Conshohocken to join us on Radio Times. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask Dr. Cook a question about something he mentioned just parenthetically. You were talking about the constitutional referendum and the changes that the military had slipped into that, basically to allow them to continue on with their economic power and not have their budget messed with by the civilian parliament and basically preserve their autonomy. And he mentioned something I actually don't think I've ever heard anyone say before, was that there are also things about those constitutional changes that were favorable to the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'm wondering, what were those elements and why were they introduced? And, you know, without jumping to a conspiracy theory, was there some sort of secret alliance between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military, or why would there have been things slipped into the Constitution that were evidently designed in their favor?
Michael, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks very much for the question, Michael. I think you're confusing two separate things here. One was the constitutional revisions that happened in February and early March of 2011 that gave a legal writ to the military to preside over the transitional period and set up the timeline for elections and the ultimate handover to civilian rule. That original election timeline benefited the Muslim Brotherhood because they are the most organized, the most well-resourced. They had an 80-year head start on all of the other, or most of the other political parties that were emerging in the immediate post-Mubarak period. What you're referring to is something that set off a more recent wave of protest and violence in Egypt going back to this past November, just before Thanksgiving, a series of supra-constitutional principles that would have shielded the military from oversight by the People's Assembly, essentially creating an autonomous space for the military to continue to pursue both its business interests, to pursue foreign and defense policy without civilian control or civilian oversight. Interestingly, many of these ideas come from the experience in Turkey, where the military is now going out of those businesses, and came from liberal elements within the Egyptian political arena, who in some ways were concerned about the Muslim Brotherhood being elected in overwhelming society. But revolutionaries were opposed to this continuing role of the military, recognizing that they are a vestige of the Mubarak era.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Stephen, how would you say that the Muslim Brotherhood and its allies, how do they view the United States in ways that you have described or even in more extreme terms?
Well, they are clearly at the moment engaged in a process of trying to socialize the United States and the international community to the fact that they can be good stewards of Egypt. But you cannot ignore the last 3-4 decades of history in which they have opposed the United States, its interests and policies in the region. And they are a pragmatic organization. It would be politically unpragmatic for them to run away from these years of opposing the United States on principle, on nationalist principle. So I think that we're going to be in for a rough time, at least from the perspective of the Egyptian People's Assembly and then ultimately some new civilian president.
But it seems to me that when groups or even individuals get into power, then they are held responsible for conditions on the ground, for what life is like under their rule or control.
That's certainly the case. People believe that there is a certain kind of moderating influence on people who hold power. In some cases, yes. In other cases, no. I don't think we can make a general statement about that. But the Brotherhood, the secret to their success is that they are saying they can do the kinds of things that the Egyptian state under Mubarak and Sadat and Nasser Bouform either did not want to do or were unable to do, and they can do it in a more democratic and open environment.
Let me get Ali from, looks like, Upper Darby to join our conversation. Ali, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I have a question about the religious movement in Egypt, the Salafi, and I wanted to know what part does the Salafi play in Egyptian society and in the Brotherhood and in politics in Egypt.
Ali, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Well, the Salafism has been in Egypt for as long as anybody can remember. It goes back to a period of Islamic reformism in the late 19th century. it is, and the easy way to think about it is Salafists believe in a kind of literal interpretation of the Quran. And they have, surprisingly to many, a Salafist party called the Al-Nur Party, Party of Light, has garnered 20% of the vote in the People's Assembly, and they will be sitting in the People's Assembly in larger number than Egyptian liberals. They are very much part of Egyptian society. They got a boost, however, from the Mubarak government in the latter part of in the 3 or 4 years before the uprising of January 25th, 2011, the interior ministry in Egypt was seeking to boost the Salafists, assuming that they would A, always be there to control the Salafists, and B, that Salafists would be politically quiescent in an effort to draw influence and support away from the Muslim Brotherhood. And this strong showing, not to take anything away from the Salafists, is in part a result of the manipulations of the late Mubarak.
Because what you read now, and when you read about Egypt today, those two groups are usually in the same sentence with the word "and" in between them. I mean, they're seen as one and the same.
Indeed. But the Muslim Brotherhood is very different from the Salafists. They do not agree on a whole range of issues, although there are some things that do unite them, this kind of call for an Islamization of society and Islamic law. But in fact, the Brotherhood is more pragmatic on these issues, is likely to align itself with liberals on certain issues, while at the same time being forced to align itself with the Salafis on kind of cultural issues and hot-button Islamist issues. But these, by no means can you expect an overwhelming Islamist bloc in the Egyptian parliament. They will be there in numbers, but you cannot guarantee that the Muslim Brotherhood's party, which is called the Freedom and Justice Party, and this An-Nur Party are going to cooperate on every issue.
I'm thinking about that video that was on YouTube of the military dragging, was a young woman, she's now known as the Blue Bra Woman because some of her clothes were pulled up and revealed that she was wearing a blue bra. What does that video tell us?
This is one of the most horrific episodes in post-uprising Egypt. I was there at the time. I was not in Tahrir during that episode, but I had been there the day before, witnessing essentially a battle between the military police and young toughs, or call them ultras, protecting the revolution on a street just adjacent to Tahrir Square in front of the cabinet building. This was horrible. Military police dropping Molotov cocktails from the tops of buildings down on Egyptians setting fire to buildings along the streets there. What it says is that in many ways that revolutionary promise, this calls for democracy and change over the course of 11 months, a difficult 11 months, there has been a certain violent aspect that has creeped into transitional Egypt that is quite worrying.
I want to pick up on that after this short break. Talking again with Stephen A. Cook, our guest today on Radio Times, author of The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. We are talking obviously about Egypt, what's been going on inside that country, its relationship to its neighbors and to the United States, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania's Clinical Doctorate in Social Work program. Are you a master's-level social worker? Have you ever thought of pursuing a doctorate and felt that your options were limited? The program enables social workers to earn a doctoral degree in just 3 years without career disruption. More information can be found online at sp2.upenn.edu/dsw or 215-898-5550.
On the next Fresh Air, Matthew Aid tells us why American intelligence officials disagreed with a key recommendation of the 9/11 Commission and how the National Security Agency once had so much electronic gear.
If you plugged in a coffee pot, you literally could knock the electricity out for an entire wing at NSA headquarters.
Matthew Aid's book is Intel Wars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up. plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Stephen A. Cook about Egypt, the subject of his new book. He's a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Paul from Levittown to join us. And Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks, there. Marty, for taking the call.
Sure.
This is a kind of a disturbing and chilling thing that I feel like I have to mention. I just recently saw Lara Logan's interview, which is in its entirety on YouTube, talking about the experience that she had when a mob in Tahrir Square pulled her away from her camera people, her bodyguards, tore her clothes off of her, penetrated her. When someone said that she was Jewish, tried to kill her, and almost did, until she somehow or other got close to some Egyptian women who protected her. And I'm just wondering if the gentleman who is with you can say whether that level of hatred, animosity, whatever you want to call it, is something that is part of the society that he's speaking about right now in general or in some areas, and just how that plays. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Go ahead.
I would say it is absolutely not representative of Egyptian society. Egyptians are preternaturally welcoming towards foreigners. But there is a dark aspect that, unfortunately, a dark aspect of the Egyptian security forces and their tactics that led to this horrible incident that Lara Logan experienced. And that is that the Interior Ministry has often used thugs, people that they have hired. And one of the tactics they used previously, predominantly against Egyptian female journalists, has been sexual assault in order to intimidate them. That began to unfold in the middle of the last decade, and as the protest movement got underway in 2003, 2004, 2005, this tactic of sexually assaulting women became the norm in order to prevent them from either covering these protests or participating in the protests themselves. It is not at all representative of Egyptians, but like every society, you have dark forces, and in this case, the Interior Ministry, which enabled this kind of criminal behavior.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stephen, let me just quote something from the Associated Press of the last couple of weeks. An Egyptian court Tuesday ordered the country's military rulers to stop the use of virginity tests on female detainees in a rare condemnation of a civilian tribunal of a military practice that has caused an uproar among activists and rights groups. The virginity test allegations surfaced after a March 9th rally in Cairo's Tahrir Square that turned violent when men in plain clothes attacked protesters and the army cleared the square. The rights group Human Rights Watch said that seven women were subjected to the test.
Again, an extraordinarily difficult issue, and one that the military themselves have said is that the facts of the case don't really comport to what the media is reporting. Of course, they would say that. But they do say that this is not a systematic military policy. There is, on the part of security forces, an effort to intimidate women from taking part. And I think what it does, it speaks to the important role that young women have played in this uprising and trying to advance the cause of a more democratic and open society. There are many liberated Egyptian women. This is not like Saudi Arabia, where women can't drive and they can't work and so on and so forth. But women have played a leading role, young women, a leading role in advancing the cause of democracy and change in Egypt.
But if the Islamists, who are doing very well in these parliamentary elections, if they gain control or more control over Egypt, what will be the fate of women in that country?
Well, this is certainly a question mark for the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist and Nur Party. The Salafis are certainly more extreme on this issue and have been clear about it. You can expect the Brotherhood to be pragmatic about it. Women take part in all aspects of Egyptian society, and you wouldn't want to try to start reversing that. But there are certainly questions concerning women who don't cover their hair, the consumption of alcohol, single women, what their rights will be under the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think there are women who are extraordinarily concerned about it. And you saw it when I was in Cairo during the second round of elections in upper class and upper middle class neighborhood of Zamalek. Women were out voting, and you knew they were not voting for either the Salafists or the Brotherhood.
Let me ask you about some raids that were on some American organizations, Freedom House, I forget the exact titles, the Democratic Institute, the Republican Institute, apparently or reportedly by the military. What's the significance of that, do you think?
A week or so ago, more than that, 2 weeks ago, the military, prosecutors, the police, the military actually ordered an investigation into the actions of Freedom House, the National Democratic Institute, which is affiliated with the Democratic Party here in the United States, and the International Republican Institute, which is affiliated with the Republican Party. There has been a problem going back to the Mubarak period with non-governmental organizations, both foreign and Egyptian, receiving foreign funds and operating in the country. The Egyptians argue that there is an NGO law that all NGOs, regardless of their origin, need to register and so on and go through legal procedures. The problem is that these laws are intended to control and restrict the space for civil society organizations to operate and do the things that they do. And NDI and IRR, which receive federal funds through the National Endowment for Democracy, have set up offices, have begun the process of going through the getting a permit to operate. Freedom House did not. Freedom House was told to get an office first and then to apply for a license, but was raided because it was operating without a license. It's kind of heads the military wins, tails the military wins. And this is an issue that upsets the military because there are U.S. government dollars flowing not just to these American organizations but Egyptian organizations, in their mind, against Egyptian law. But these groups are only trying to promote a more democratic Egypt. And it has caused a furor, an absolute furor. And if the military was good to its word about preparing Egypt for a democratic future, they would see these organizations as allies, especially since the military says they don't know much about this mission of preparing the country for a democracy. You would think that they would want to see these organizations as assets. So it suggests clearly, as if any people didn't know, that the military was not as interested in being with the legitimate demands of the Egyptian people from January 25th, 2011, and promoting a more democratic Egypt.
But doesn't the Egyptian military get American dollars, gets money from the United States?
That's the astonishing irony of all of this. The Egyptian military gets $1.3 billion a year from the United States. Now, it's the same $1.3 billion that they've been getting since 1983, so it's about worth 40 or 50% of that, still a sizable amount of money. And so for them to argue that these groups are receiving foreign funding from the same people who appropriate the money from them is, as I said, an astonishing irony and has caused a furor.
You described the relationship between the United States and Egypt as this long goodbye, obviously going through a very a big transitional period. If the U.S. were to stop giving money to Egypt, what would that mean for Egypt, do you think?
Well, the aid program goes back to the late 70s, early 1980s, actually even before that. This is a very different country. On the eve of the revolution, the Egyptian economy was north of $100 billion a year. Even the $1.3 billion that we've been appropriating to the military was no longer huge money. It was no longer 20% of their budget that it once was. And there, the economic aid, which once was $1 billion, had been reduced to $200 million, most of it geared not towards economic development, but towards good governance programs and so on and so forth. It is important symbolically because it's informally linked to the Camp David Accords and the Egypt-Israel Peace Treaty. But on a practical level, Egyptians probably could get by without it. Hmm. It is, though, a source that we like to believe, Americans like to believe, is a source of leverage over the Egyptians. I think we have a lot less leverage than we think we do, though.
And we're talking about Egypt with Stephen A. Cook, and we have just a few open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We haven't talked about the fact that Hosni Mubarak was not only toppled by this uprising, he's actually on trial in Egypt. And what is he charged with? What are the charges against him?
Well, he's charged with murder for ordering the killing of 800-plus protesters during the 18-day uprising. He's also charged with various counts of corruption. There have been, reports that the Mubarak family has $80 billion. Of course, those are clearly not true. But there are credible reports that they have misappropriated Egyptian funds. And people are seeking for the Mubarak family, Hosni and his two sons, Gamal and Alaa, to answer for these crimes. My own sense is that no good can come from this, regardless of how the outcome of the trial, which is likely to go on and on and on for a long time. At the time that they announced the trial, I suggested perhaps a better way to have gone was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
But why not a trial? I mean, why do you say no good can come from this?
Well, first, it's going to drag on for a while, and it has become a distraction to the very hard work of political organizing and putting Egypt on the right track and preparing it for a transition to something better than it was. Is also because the death sentence actually hangs over Mubarak and long jail sentences for his two sons, there is obviously going to be – there's an incentive or a disincentive on the part of the Mubarak defense team to fess up, to give Egyptians what they want, which is a full accounting of what happened during those 30 years. So I think it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a divisive and potentially destabilizing issue as long as this trial goes on.
What do you see as the future relationship between Egypt and Israel going forward? Of course, a very fraught part of the world and a fraught relationship as well.
Absolutely fraught relationship. And I would expect that there's going to be a divergence of relations between the two countries. Again, I don't expect that there will be a breach in the peace treaty, although credible polls show that more than half of the Egyptian public want to renegotiate critical aspects of the treaty, including Egypt's sale of gas to Israel, including the demilitarization of the Sinai, which really limits Egyptian sovereignty on its own territory. The problem with the Egypt-Israel peace treaty is that the treaty makes Egyptians feel weak. From the Egyptian perspective, as a result of that treaty, Israel and the United States have essentially been able to pursue their interests in the Middle East unfettered, with the Egyptians on the sideline, either playing a supporting role behind the scenes or lamely protesting at the Israeli Foreign Ministry or at the State Department. This is not what this proud country that is, from the Egyptian perspective, should be leading the region, should be doing. They should be holding Israelis accountable for their actions in the West Bank or Lebanon or wherever. And that's not what they've been doing. And I think you're going to see a movement back towards that.
Because of the changed relationship with the United States and also just the changing region of this world, of the world?
I think the primary driver of it is domestic politics. Public opinion demands these kinds of changes. It's the same thing with the United States. Ultimately, the good news is, though, if Egypt regains a certain amount of regional luster that it lost during this long period of Hosni Mubarak's rule, if it can carve out a more independent foreign policy of the United States and, by association, Israel, it will likely be a more appropriate interlocutor for the United States in the region because it will really truly represent what is going on in the Arab world. And that's one of the things that attracted Washington to Egypt in the first place, the strategic alignment that Egypt was a powerful, important, influential player. It no longer is.
When you look at Egypt, and perhaps if you look ahead for 5 years or 10 years or another generation, do you have an image, a picture of what you think that country will be?
Well, I have an image of what its potential can be, but there are obstacles to that kind of, you know, pot at the end of the rainbow. It's not a coincidence that I called the book The Struggle for Egypt. Mm-hmm. We're not going to come back. I'm not going to come back to Philadelphia 6 months from now and say, well, it's all over, everything's good. We're talking about a multi-year process, years, three, five, perhaps a decade, until Egyptians answer the kinds of antecedent questions about what kind of society they want before they can really move forward. So I'm afraid it's going to be uncertain and potentially unstable for a while. But Egypt has enormous resources in terms of human resources. If they can only educate their people, it sits on the Suez Canal. It has enormous potential in terms of tourism. And 15 million people visited Egypt in 2008 to see the great antiquities of ancient Egypt. It has tremendous things to offer. It could be an enormously successful country. It's had bad leadership.
We're almost out of time here, but you begin your book talking about meeting a young man in Cairo, Hassan. I'm assuming you have people, friends there that you can check in with just to kind of find out, to get a sense of what's happening in Egypt in a granular kind of way.
Indeed, Hassan is an old and very dear friend, and he was gracious in allowing me to profile him in the introduction to the book. I check in with them regularly via either Facebook or email or over the phone.
Sure.
And Twitter actually has been an important tool for me when I can't be there. I'm a frequent traveler to Cairo, and that's the best way to check in with them at a granular level. But Hassan has gone from euphoria over the uprising to a dark place. He's quite concerned about the future of Egypt in the short and medium term.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Stephen A. Cook has been our guest, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. And he's a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including Twitter and Facebook, the archives, and email. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.